And I suggest that the liberal-spirited scientist who comes to feel reverence toward, confidence in, and communion with the physical universe, of which man, to be sure, is a part, has found a better basis for a genuinely religious temper than has the capital-lettered humanist. And I think I'll just let it go at that, as saying that I have the same feeling about it, and will not then discuss religion further in the contemporary variety of humanism. The conflict of educational ideas since the days of Huxley and Arnold has been sometimes described as an unbroken series of victories for science. It was chiefly the spread of scientific studies that broke down the required curriculum. Huxley's instruction in the laws of nature was a humanistic concept compared with the orgy of minute classification and methodological investigations which followed. And Arnold's concept of culture has been repudiated most savagely by literary critics who will not accept the authority of the past nor submit to any touchstones. The issues in the contemporary controversies about general education are not really struggles between science and the humanities. Everyone knows that the humanities may be very inhuman, and that science has turned its attention to human relations in a way that may be very humane. Nor is it a struggle to any very great degree over the curriculum. There's a pretty general agreement over the balance to be sought by exposing all students to subjects in the areas of the natural sciences, the social sciences, and the humanities. A pretty large place is guaranteed to the humanities if they can learn how to fill it in the way that's expected. The scientists have been alarmed at the result of their own victories. Deans of medical schools are the most eloquent champions of pre-medical studies in the social sciences and the humanities. Engineering conventions outline and prescribe courses in world literature and great books. Personnel officers in great industries and banks and insurance companies all testify that technical specialists are plentiful and cheap, that personal qualities and human relationships are more important in the long run than technical skill. It cannot be said that these physicians and engineers are chiefly concerned that their students should be able to quote freely from Chaucer and Shakespeare, Pope and Dryden. The day of the dominance of polite learning, I fear, is over. And yet, one senses a sort of nostalgic longing for the kind of easy intercourse that was possible when liberally educated gentlemen did talk pleasantly of literature, manners, and morals in a common discourse. But the desire now in general education is to enable us to do our common duties together with understanding and sympathy. Not only for the sales purpose of winning friends and influencing people, but also to lessen tensions, decrease hostility, and make the democratic process more possible. The humanities seem somehow connected with all this, and yet the intuitive insights of literature seem to give way to a more scientific study of human behavior. We do not believe that students of literature are notably well-adjusted and happy people, nor do we believe that badly adjusted students are set right by the study of literature. We are turning more and more to the clinical psychologist or to the psychiatrist to produce human understanding and cooperation. Instead of reserving this approach for a few unfortunate misfits, we come to feel in this age of anxiety that a happy, well-adjusted individual working efficiently at something he thinks worth doing is almost a miracle of nature. Instead of quoting or merely quoting a simple proverb, "He that ruleth his spirit is better than he that taketh a city," we now footnote this with a study of the unconscious and an investigation of parent-child relationships. Let me cite a few examples of common student difficulties that seem to require something more than a humanistic curriculum well taught. Roy came in the other day to announce that he was quitting college because it was doing him no good. He came, he said, to formulate a theory of the universe, and none of his courses seemed to give him the answers. He was a lonely and unhappy chap who projected all his woes onto the nature of the universe, and he wanted a formula which would solve all his problems. And he was too unhappy to wait with any patience while he fitted bits of learning and experience together. Another boy, a quite opposite temperament, didn't like the curriculum of general education because he couldn't immediately see his vocational future. He was acutely unhappy at being asked to learn something that had no apparent, immediate cash value. Nothing in his background had given him any intellectual curiosity. and it didn't do me any good to talk to him about the values of general education. He was unhappy, and he wanted to go and get a job, and he did. Another student reacted against the whole idea of a required curriculum and against the content of many of his courses because he had always hated authority in all forms. He had hated his father's paternalism. He had hated the officers in the army. He had hated his superiors in every job he'd held. And he found his whole hope in espousing Marxism as a means of driving all he hated out of the world. He was a very brilliant student. I suspect he will be a thoroughgoing Marxist the rest of his life and will love it, and that no amount of reasoning is going to affect him. There is that raging resentment in his mind, which was there long before he got to college. And you say, well, the curriculum is rather powerless at dealing with such a problem. Still another student, a near genius in mathematics and physics, wanted relief from such subjects as economics and history. And he also wanted relief from his classmates, who, he said, wanted him to go into dramatics and become a well-rounded wheel. And he resented that. He said he really felt significant and important only when he was excelling. And he was excelling when he was working at mathematics and physics. And he was uncomfortable at all other times. And when I consulted our psychiatrist about it, he said, well, he'd better go right on at mathematics and physics and feel secure. You'll just break him down if you try to give him a general education. Some students early acquire a passion for exactitude. They are happy when they find that something can be that way and no other. And they are outraged by bull courses in which widely different answers may receive the same grade. I still remember the Navy student during the war who said to me just before a test, do you want facts or bull? I learned later that he had asked a professor of philosophy that and had been ordered out of the room, and he was trying it on me. And I said, why, bull, of course, this is a bull course. That's what I want you to do. And he said, well, in these courses, and he quoted this, in these courses, opposite answers get the same grade. What's the use? Others equally early come to the conviction that nothing worth proving can be proved, and they abstain zealously from any information which might prove anything. The more one investigates the causes of academic failure, the more one comes to the conviction that it is not abstract intelligence that is lacking, but that personality patterns and emotional drives formed long before the college years are the principal factors. John Stuart Mill felt that if the fallacies of the intellect could be noted and classified, the fallacies of the feelings would be impotent. That type of rationalism still exists among some faculty members, but we are having it more and more driven in upon us that we really need to start with the fallacies of feeling. The psychological study of college students, in spite of the flood of tests and measurements, is only beginning. And I believe we shall find it as important in the promotion of a sound humanism as any readjustments of the curriculum. Now let's look briefly at the qualities of some teachers and the obstacles they put in the way of a humanistic presentation of a general curriculum. First, take the devotion to a highly specialized interest. A professor in a medical school told me the other day that the best medical students were those who changed over from electrical engineering. I asked him why, and he said they invariably made the best grades in his courses. The standards set by the American Chemical Society for accrediting colleges present a great pressure towards specialization, which have little concern with breadth of education. But the pressures towards specialization are almost as great in the fields of social sciences and in the humanities as they are in the natural sciences. And I think they are all so familiar with any academic audience that I don't need to put more emphasis on them here. The rewards for specialization, I think, are greater in the universities. And the penalties for ignoring that which lies before us in daily life are lighter in the universities than in almost any other form of community life. And if you merely have to say he's a professor to excuse him from most of the obligations of citizenship. The very ideal of good citizenship is to many specialists synonymous with an ideal of mediocrity. Anyone can be a good husband, a kind father, and a good citizen. And you often hear that phrase used to praise a man with faint dams when you want to say that he's a man of no ability. It's only when some other specialist analyzes the divorce rate as an evidence of unhappiness and the effects on children of hating their father that we realize how difficult it is to be lowly wise. I think the the general affairs of daily life, which to Adam must have been so simple, are getting really a little more dignity in our minds now when we find that they may be the field of specialized subject matter. That if that thing which you would despise as an ordinary thing can be the result of a monograph, then there's something respectable to it. And if the divorce rate shows that there are very few happy husbands in the country, you may then be proud of an achievement in being one. And it may, in that way, have a considerable emphasis on a humanistic conception. But the earlier humanists, and I would include Milton, Dr. Johnson, nearly all of them, it seemed to me, did not really look at human life about them. They wanted to impose upon it an authoritative thing to make it the kind of human life they thought it ought to be. And I'm not sure when we see the results of some of our psychological treatment of human nature whether that's all we hope for or not. But at any rate, it does look squarely at that which lies daily before us. It does reason about it. It does patiently seek out cases. And there is, therefore, hope of great progress. And the great hope is that it does very closely look into that which lies before us in daily life and therefore may become, it seems to me, one of the greatest of the humanities. I have suggested, there are some limitations to that I want to mention, though. I have suggested that any subject may be a humanity, and that any subject may be inhumane, and also that personality patterns formed before the college years may be more influential than the curriculum in determining permanent attitudes. But I want now, finally, to suggest a particular function of the humanities in general education. The natural and the social sciences, and psychology, I believe, is all three, all proceed largely by a process of abstraction. They isolate a factor from its environment in order to control and study it, or study and control it. Literature, on the other hand, gives us the concrete quality of experience, and it should humanize in a way that is hardly possible through the other disciplines. When I note a certain hard abstractness in the zeal of social reformers, and particularly youthful social reformers of the undergraduate age, they will organize constitutions of world government or amend a sophomore class organization with equally blind faith in a political process. They will feel that all difficulties of racial relations may be solved by simple anti-discriminatory legislation. They sometimes seem to want to reform everything because they seem to love nothing that is, but could only love it if it's different. And it may be that a humanist is a conservative. I hope not a hopeless one, but I think a humanist ought to love some things, even as they are. Having read the Kinsey Report, they demand their statistical sexual rights. One could, I suppose, deduce something of the conclusions of the Kinsey Report from the stories of Lancelot and Guinevere or Tristan and Isolde. But one would never understand the moving power of these stories from a study of the statistics of sex. Mr. Kinsey, I'm sure, understands the limits of his methods, but many of his readers do not. And the same may be said for sociological studies of Middletown and other communities, or the many studies of comparative culture patterns. They give us very little of the qualities of the experience they tabulate. When John Stuart Mill fell into his period of despair, he came to feel that even the immediate adoption of all of his projected reforms would mean nothing to him. If he had been merely an intellectual, he would have said that something was wrong with his ideology. He might have tried to build another system. But with rare psychological insight, he decided that his habit of intellectual analysis had dried up his emotions. He began his recovery by an appreciation of Wordsworth's poetry and a realization of the simple emotional values they celebrated. All of us need some supplement to our analytical thinking. Literature and the shaping spirit of the imagination can give us the qualities of experience: variety, flexibility, detachment, humor, pathos, a sense of tragedy, and a host of imaginative creatures whom we can love. Well, the progress of the program of general education is not easy. Curriculum makers can abstract from contemporary life the qualities we need for successful living and successful cooperation, and then they can assign these qualities to the various disciplines, much as a top executive assigns duties to a group of vice presidents. Those of us who are not interested in science may very easily come to feel that a year or two of science ought to be enough to give a grasp of scientific method and a knowledge of the habits of observation, of the creation of hypotheses and their verification. But the scientist knows how hard his habits are to acquire. And it's not really surprising that he should be impatient about science courses for non-scientists. We can more easily understand how hard it is to instill a love of literature into the unperceptive lovers of facts within the short courses of general education. I once had a term paper on Homer's Odyssey from an engineer. He made a map of the travels of Ulysses. He computed ocean currents and wind currents and concluded that Ulysses could not possibly have arrived on scheduled time. He had done so thorough a job of it that I gave him an A, concluding in self-defense that he would have had as hard a time as me in attempting to teach me quantitative values within one semester. We shall have to admit, I think, that we shall never be satisfied with our performance in general education. A specialist in any field is bound to look with disappointment on the shortcomings of students in the introductory courses.